Welcome to Inside Track. Santa Aurelia LLC is solely responsible for its content. The views and opinions expressed on Inside Track are those of the host and guests, and not necessarily endorsed by KVOI or its advertisers, but they should be. And now, here's Bruce Ash.
Hello, Insiders, and a very pleasant good afternoon to you, wherever you may be. This is Bruce Ash and
Deb Wilkinson,
welcoming you to a special Wuhan Virus Quarantine Day 33 edition of Inside Track. We have another great show for you this afternoon. After we hear in just a moment from Pima Treasurer Beth Ford, we will speak with Pima County Supervisor candidate Bill Beard. And Bill's going to chat with us about his campaign, and you know, he faces a multi-person primary here in August on the 4th. After the bottom of the hour break, John Tierney will be with us for the balance of the show, talking about the fossilization of the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, in the era of the Wuhan virus. Our tank is filled up as usual with great guests this afternoon, so please, you could join us today. Big news this week from the Plugs Biden campaign. Old Joe finally got his endorsement from Barack Obama on Wednesday. Some good it'll do him. What Obama pointed out is what most of America has already figured out. Joe Biden ain't no moderate. The presumptive candidate, according to his former boss, has, quote, the most progressive, that's code for leftist, platform in presidential history. He's AOC light, but he's still a leftist, even so with confused loss of memory. But the biggest news of the past week is we're getting close to reopening business up here in Tucson, Arizona, and elsewhere across America. We grieve for the losses of loved ones, friends, and colleagues from the Wuhan virus. But there are also so many, many trillions of dollars lost and careers ruined, businesses wrecked by the survivors of the virus, as well as not only the rich, but anyone with a pension, IRA, or 401k. Prior to the virus, our Arizona economy had never been stronger, employment participation never so high, and wages never so good. Initial predictions here in Arizona showed we might lose over 1,000 lives in Arizona. So far, our losses as of this morning are about 178.
We're closing in.
We mourn their loss. We've done a great job to flatten the curve. Our predictions now from the health department authorities are between 260 or 270. Look for the president and our governor to open us up for business in the next 2 to 3 weeks. As weather warms up, we'll get the Wuhan virus in back of us, get to work, and prepare for this winter when we will be much better equipped to take on this virus when it returns. For now, I think we can all agree it's time to open up Arizona. Hey, Regina, are you listening? Can you hear me from your bunker? It's time to open up again. It's also time for Nancy Pelosi to return to the Capitol and start voting for additional relief, which is urgently needed to help save the jobs of over 22 million Americans who've lost their jobs and help us return to normalcy. Stop staying up late, talking to TV, talk show host, eating your $20 pint of ice cream from your $20,000 refrigerator, and get the hell back to work, so the rest of us can get our lives returned back to us as well. And by the way, Nancy, when you fly back on your private jet, won't you please stop along the way at LaGuardia Airport on your way back to D.C. and bring home your New Yorker friend from the Senate, Chucky Schumer? It's time all of you SOBs get back to work and do your damn jobs. Okay, enough about viruses and corrupt Democrat socialists. I'm pleased to welcome, we're pleased, Eb and I are both pleased to welcome the treasurer of Pima County, Beth Ford, who is a candidate for re-election. Beth, how are you today?
I'm doing great. Thank you, Bruce.
I'm revved up, as you can see.
Uh-huh.
You made news this past week for a proposal that you made to the county administrator, Mr. Huckleberry. You suggested moving payments for tax, or real estate taxes, to June 1. I think I got that right. The county administrator rejected. Can you tell our audience about it? And will supervisors ever get to vote on your suggestion? Even if we really don't have the ability to make that decision, because I guess it's a legislator thing, but wouldn't it be a great symbolic message?
Actually, Bruce, it's the County Treasurers Association that has been proposing to the legislature to move the delinquency date back to June. And we started talking about this when they started deferring income taxes.
Right.
Knowing that the delinquency date of May 1st was coming up, people were starting to lose their jobs. The economy was just starting to shut down. And I notified Chuck about our intentions to do that March 20th.
Mm-hmm.
So he and I never really had any conversations about it at all. The next thing I knew, he issued a memo April 2nd, basically stating that it was a nice thought but not well thought out by the county treasurers because the political subdivisions needed their tax revenues. But he doesn't really understand how the treasurer's office really works. That delay is not necessarily going to hurt the districts that significantly, and the treasurer's office basically operates like a bank for our 96 political subdivisions in Pima County. So we accept deposits in, and as long as we've got deposits, we can turn around and make loans, much like a bank. So we basically kind of offer overdraft protection for the political subdivisions. If they run out of cash, we basically loan them the cash. I have over $500 million in pooled cash on the books right now, and our outflows went about $200 million. So we've got plenty of cash to cover our political subdivisions.
Beth, when you our say 200 millions of outflows, that's over what period of time?
A month.
Okay.
Sorry. Important detail. But our taxpayers need some relief. Many people are waiting for the relief that they're getting from the federal government. They haven't gotten it yet. PPP has run out of money for our businesses. We're getting calls every day from many taxpayers asking if there's going to be a pushback of that delinquency date. If the delinquency date isn't pushed back and people can't pay their taxes, there's a 16% penalty for those late payments.
From day one.
And that's from day one, starting May 2nd. And that's just not right for our taxpayers in Pima County. They deserve this relief. This was imposed on them by government.
Right.
And government shouldn't be penalizing them.
And I think that's the point that you get very, very clearly, is that this wasn't something that, you know, they just figured they didn't have to pay or they couldn't pay because they had a job and decided to buy a new car or something. They're out of work right now because of government order.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And I'll give you a good example. I talked to a taxpayer that owns a small commercial building, and she has two tenants. One's a music school, one's a restaurant. Both are closed down.
Right.
No rent's coming in.
Wow.
So she has no cash to be able to pay. Think of like beauty salons where they rent out the stations. The hairdressers can't work. They can't pay rent, so nobody can pay rent for that salon. There's a lot of instances with businesses like that in Pima County that need some relief.
So, Beth, even though you couldn't or the county couldn't arbitrarily move that date, can the county Board of Supervisors waive the late fees if they decided to?
No, they have no authority over basically the operations of my office. They're all governed by Arizona revised statutes, so that change is going to have to come through the legislature or the governor's office by executive order. The statutes are very specific that delinquency date of May 1st is there. Plus, there's another statute that dictates when I can waive interest. And the only time I can waive interest is if the delinquency was caused because of an error by the assessor's office or the treasurer's office. So even if my mother made her payment late, bless her soul, I still wouldn't be able to waive the interest.
So, Beth, you're running for re-election. Your office is one that probably 65% of all Pima County has direct contact with in some fashion, besides receiving and accounting for property taxes and general revenue. In the short minutes we have here, what else does your office handle? You mentioned you're kind of the bank.
We, and that's a big chunk of our business.
Yeah.
Um, we We have about $3 billion that flows through that office every year. We accept deposits from all 96 different political subdivisions, and then we clear their checks as well. And then those deposits that I have that I was talking about, we're actually at about almost $1 billion at the moment. Those funds are invested. And then, as I said, if somebody's short of cash, we end up covering those deficits. I would have the option of being able to get a line of credit with the bank, but elected not to do that because they're too expensive.
Right.
Even with our interest rate environment at zero now, the interest rates that our political subdivisions would have to pay would be over 3%. And we're earning less than 2% on our investments now. So by keeping those loans in-house, Pima County gets to benefit from that, not the bank.
And Treasurer Ford, in your years running the Treasurer's Office in Pima County, there's never been one issue. There's never been one problem. There's never been any sort of scandals. Your department runs like so efficiently.
Thank you. And that's true.
It's true. We tell the truth here.
Even during the financial collapse back in the Great Recession in 2008, we didn't lose any principal on any of our investments.
Yeah.
Beth, how long have you been there?
I've been there for 20 years. And I'll tell you, the reason that I'm running for this term in particular is because we have so many new people coming into office. We're going to end up with a new recorder. We're going to have a new assessor, new county attorney, and I really felt that we needed to have some of that institutional memory still sticking around. So I decided to run again and to help my colleagues break into the world of being an elected official.
So, Beth, if people want to help your campaign, how do they do that?
They can visit my website at fordfortreasurer.com.
And they're able to give online there securely, I presume?
Yes, they can.
All right. Well, Beth, we'll have you back on the show again soon. This was a kind of a last-minute thing because we wanted to make sure we got you on the air to talk about this tax payment business. Friends, this lady is one hell of a professional, not your normal politician. Beth is committed to serving all taxpayers. And, Beth, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me on, Bruce, and I'll keep you posted.
All right. Thanks very much. When we return from the break, we'll hear from Bill Beard, who is running to fill the open seat in Supervisor District Number 1. You're listening to Inside Track. Stay tuned. Hey, when is the last time you washed your damn hands? We'll be right back after Eb and I
wash our hands.
And wash our hands also.
Come play and discover at Children's Museum Oro Valley. Specially sized for kids 0 to 5 years old, Children's Museum Oro Valley gives our youngest visitors the chance to explore and learn in a cozy, comfortable space filled with sensory exhibits that help build fine motor skills, foster a love of reading, and jumpstart their creativity and imagination. Children's Museum Oro Valley is in the Steampunk Village Shops on Oracle Road. Visit cmorovalley.com for more information.
Imus Wilkinson Investments, 777-1911, is a unique investment management firm. They pay little attention to where the market indicators are because smart investment management goes way beyond checking stock exchanges. They are very good at managing all types of investment based on client expectations. They build relationships, and they want clients, not customers. My family is proudly included among them, and they'll help you, as they did us, design a portfolio that achieves what you want when you need it. Imus Wilkinson Investments, they're really good at what they do. 777-1911.
Jamie Kipper and her father, Gary Kipper, from Tucson Iron and Metal. What are they going to see when they come through the gates?
So when they come on in, they'll see our building up front. People have free rein to then go out and look in the yard. So it's not a typical scrapyard with a ton of big machinery. We have a couple of forklifts around, but that's about it just to help move material. So when you come in, it's all organized by material, whether it's square tubing, angle iron, roofing, and then there is a pile in the back, which is still organized and easy to get through, but that's stuff that comes over from the scrap. So we're unique in that we get stuff in from the scrap, which a lot of artists and people will like or reuse, whether it's a sink that someone needs for their house. We sell literally anything made of metal.
Tucson Iron and Metal Surplus. Call 209-1579. Stop by the yard, 701 East 36th Street. Open Monday through Saturday. Welcome back to Inside Track. Before we get to Bill, Eb and I very much hope you will continue to support all of our Inside Track sponsors. Eb Wilkinson and Gary Imus at Imus Wilkinson Asset Management. Jerry, I did it again. Jamie and Gary Kipper at Tucson Iron and Metal Retail. And the
sorry,
folks
Gary.
And the folks at Corazon Cabinets, Joy, Allie, and David. Each of our sponsors has been with Inside Track from the start. These are great companies you should do business with. I really do mean what I say, even though I forget Gary's name from time to time. I do business with each of them. They're great people. Speaking of great local companies you should do business with, Corazon Cabinets is your locally owned wholesale one-stop source for high-quality kitchen, bath, and office cabinets, as well as designer services. Do you have a home improvement project planned later this year? Corazon Cabinets sells quality J&K, Yorktown, and Waypoint cabinets. We offer professional design services for your home also. Call Corazon Cabinets at 488-2266 and schedule a visit to the showroom. It's an easy number to remember, 488-2266. Tell Joy, Allie, or David you heard this ad with Bruce and Eb on Inside Track and get an additional 5% discount on their already low wholesale prices. Okay, on to our guest, friend of the show, patriot, and candidate for Pima Supervisor in District 1, Bill Beard.
Well, good afternoon, Bruce, and thank you for having me on the show today.
You bet. You have big shoes to fill. This show's founder, Emil Franzi, referred to the Chuck Huckleberry Pima Supervisors as the Board of Observers. Now, Allie Miller, who you would be replacing, certainly is not an observer. It'll be hard to replace her, so how do you intend to do so?
Well, I thank you for the intro, but one of the things that I have come to realize about both Pima County and this particular office I'm running for, as you said, it's going to take somebody that is not afraid of taking hard stances. And one of the ways I hope to carry on and hopefully someday fill those very large shoes is do something I've been doing for a long time in Pima County. I've kind of lived rent-free in Chuck's mind for a long time now, and I want to continue to do that, but this time as an elected official. There's been a lot of occasions over the years, be it election integrity, be it transparency of Pima County government, just standing up and telling the Board of Supervisors and Chuck Huckleberry they're doing it wrong is something I've been doing for a very long time. And I don't mind standing up and taking unpopular positions, but if I know that they're right and the facts back me up, I'm not afraid to stand up there if I've got to do it by myself and say, you're doing it wrong.
Well, Allie's been sometimes the only one saying you're doing it wrong. That's, it takes a lot of courage to do that. She's done that. I've known you for a long time. You're not afraid to speak up.
And I think it touches on one of the main reasons I got interested in this race. I'm a native, and I'll be blunt. I'm sick and tired of watching a place I dearly love be undermined and destroyed. My roots go deep in this community. My great-grandfather came out here in the 1890s. He did some mining down in Bisbee and in northern Sonora, but he eventually got a job with the Southern Pacific Railroad, and he realized that this is a really great place that you can raise your family and provide a future, not just for yourself, but your kids, your grandkids, et cetera. And I think for a lot of folks today, they can't say that anymore. We've got a local government that seems to wrap itself into these tighter and tighter bundles of inability to do anything because they've spent all our tax dollars on a bunch of feel good for the moment kind of things, but they don't get the basics right. We don't fix the roads. We don't support the sheriff, our chief law enforcement officer. We wind ourselves up in these super complicated contracts that only the cronies benefit from. We have to stop that. We don't need to raise taxes. Simple, straightforward things that are the reason I'm in this race. We've got to go back to a situation where the Board of Supervisors in Pima County gets the basics right. Until we do those things, all of the other things people want to talk about, frankly, are pointless to talk about because there's no money to fix awesome.
So, Bill, I'm going to ask you the question that Charles Heller is sitting by his radio dying to hear the answer to. What is the stated purpose of government?
All political power is inherent in the people, and governments derive their just powers from the consent of the governed and are established to protect and maintain individual rights.
Right out of Article 2, Section 2.
Amen. And, you know, if you are not, as an elected official, even as an appointed official, if your first thought when you show up for work today and the last thought you have as you close out your day is protecting the rights of the citizens, you're not doing your job. I would only amend that to one thing, and it, and I say this only in the sense that if we don't remind ourselves of certain basics, it's easy to overlook them. And in addition to looking out for the rights of citizens, you've got to mind what's going on with the Treasury. Where are the tax dollars being spent? Now, that's a direct result of protecting the rights of citizens, but I've found when government officials at any level stop paying attention to where the dollars are coming from and where they're going to, they're not doing their job of protecting the rights of citizens, because ultimately, at the end of the conversation, those dollars are a direct result of the freedoms of our citizens. It can be a complicated argument for some people to wrap their brains around, but to my mind, it is the most simple one. The money that's coming in came from the sweat, blood, tears, toil of a lot of different people all across Pima County.
So
if you're
Bill,
not paying attention, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Yeah, if you're not paying attention to that fact each and every day, you are not doing your job.
Name three areas where dollars are misspent.
We can start with the things like worldview. The sad reality is, at the end of the 2018-2019 fiscal year, there was a $61 million budget surplus in the various accounts of Pima County. One of the ways that comes about is because when they passed the budget the previous year, they knew that there were going to be X number of additional jobs in each one of the budget lines that they knew purposely they were not going to fill them. Therefore, there was some extra money they could put off into their little crony deals and their little side programs that made for political victory in the short term, but in the long term, took money away from the needed programs, the roads, public safety, the parks, those things that they're supposed to be taking
care
of.
Okay, so that's one.
That's just, okay. Well, everything in this is about the decision-making process of the budgets. If you pass a budget where you know you've got extra jobs over here that you're never going to fill, that money is being diverted into other things. That's number one. Pass programs that go directly to the basic priorities. Roads is the first thing. I've yet to run across somebody, whether they're a Republican, a Democrat, or pick your poison on political party, that likes the condition of the roads in Pima County. Chuck Huckleberry likes to send out memos talking about how we just don't have any more money for spending on roads because it's all taken up. I would submit that when you pass a budget that's got $61 million extra dollars in all the various line items, number one, you're doing a poor job of budgeting, but number two, you're basically deceiving the citizens and taxpayers. You have to have transparency. You have to provide a means by which the basics are getting taken care of. And at the end of the day, if you're trying to wrap it up in single-sourced contracts and crony deals that only a handful of people are privileged to win at the end of the day, you're not doing your job, and more importantly, you're actually taking money out of the hands of the people that need that money for their daily lives, but you've diverted it over into these specialty programs.
Former State Senator Frank Antonori has endorsed you. He said Pima County needs a tireless advocate to expose and question the use of taxpayer dollars. Someone unafraid to challenge the entrenched political machines. Bill will be both the watchdog and public servant that Pima County deserves. You've also received endorsements from three of our county's real conservatives, former city council member Kathleen Dunbar, former state rep Terry Proud, I wish she was still in the legislature, and Captain Al Melvin. And Al, I take special note because of my trust in the work that he's done himself. He says, as an Arizona state senator, 2009 to 2015, I was impressed with his hardworking public service. I share his priorities of fixing the roads, election integrity, protecting our Second Amendment rights, and promoting small businesses. He will do a great job as Pima County Supervisor in District 1. That's pretty high praise. Now, this doesn't happen just by a bunch of endorsements. What are you doing to go out there and win the vote?
Well, I'm truly honored by the people that have come forward. You know, Senator Frank Antonori, Senator Al Melvin, Representatives Proud, Kathleen Dunbar, and even Chris Ackerley. All of these people I've gotten to know over the years, not just working with them individually, but working in the same fields, trying to get those conservative principles we talk about, that you talk about infrequently on this show, making headway on achieving those goals. Since day one with this campaign, I have been out knocking on doors, making phone calls, getting face-to-face with the citizens, the voters of District 1, and laying out exactly what it is this campaign's about. You mentioned them: roads, public safety, making sure that we end the crony deals and you can do all those things and not raise taxes.
Okay, Billy, take a breath for 1 second. We got Mark on the line with a comment. We're going to go ahead and take Mark. We got a real quick turnaround here as we need to go to break.
Sure.
Mark, go ahead.
Okay, thanks for this great show today. And Bill, I'm so glad you're trying to replace someone who I cherish, Allie Miller. And anyway, so that was the most clear, concise, well-spoken purpose of somebody running for a position that I've heard in a very long time, if not ever. And I really hope you get in there and beat the opponents. And we're going to have an enormous problem coming up because there's going to be no money. The economy has failed, and there's going to be no income for, talk about no money for roads. There's going to be no money. So I think the county's going to have to sell off assets to come up with money.
A real quick comment, Bill, then we need to go to break. Do you have a comment for Mark?
He's right on target. The county, the city, all levels of government have to be planning right now for serious cuts in their budget simply because the economy has ground to a screeching halt. I've talked about it lately in a couple of op-eds. You can see them at our website, beardforsupervisor.com, or check us out on Facebook, also there, Beard for Supervisor. I'm going to close with this, Bruce. At the end of all of this, if we do not have representatives that are in there that are not afraid of asking the tough questions about where the money's being spent, why it's being spent on the things the majority seems to want to spend it on, you are not going to have a successful economy, a successful government, a successful environment for any of us to live in moving forward. I'm in this race to ask those tough questions, to make sure that the basics get covered, and I want to be a representative that understands those things from day one, and I believe I'm the right guy to do that.
Bill, thanks very much. We're late. We've got to take our bottom-of-the-hour break. Thanks for joining us today. We will have you back soon. And this is also an invitation to all Republican candidates for office. If you contact me, I'll do my best to get you on Inside Track. It's pretty easy to reach me, so no one should have an excuse not to be on the show. When we come back, Manhattan Institute scholar John Tierney will join us for the balance of today's show. We'll be talking about the fossilized FDA and how it has created a great loss of life here in our country. You're listening to Inside Track. Stay tuned.
A social distancing tip.
Putting distance between yourself and others is critical to slowing the spread of coronavirus. So here are ways to stay in contact without the physical contact part. Call, send a text, set up a video conference, post on social media, dedicate a song on the radio. If you have symptoms of fever, dry cough, and shortness of breath, call your health care provider before going to their office. For more info, visit coronavirus.gov.
Let's all do our part, because we're all #alone together. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
Customers come first at Tucson Iron and Metal Surplus.
My main goal is to make everything easy for the customer, whether every decision I make in terms of business is, will this make sense for the customer, and is this make it easier for the customer to come and look at material, how the yard is organized, what material we cover, what material we offer, anything like that.
Tucson Iron and Metal Surplus. Call 209-1579. Stop by the yard, 701 East 36th Street. Open Monday through Saturday.
As you know, I advertise restaurants where I eat and recommend services my family and I use ourselves. Our money issues are handled by Imus Wilkinson, 3561 East Sunrise, 777-1911. Most folks need a good financial advisor for more than one reason. Here's one of the best ones. They'll keep you from doing really stupid things with your investments and property. Remember when it seemed lots of people planned to get rich borrowing money on their house so they could buy another one? It's now called the housing bubble. I have friends, as do you, who lost their homes playing that game, who would have been saved by decent financial advice like you get from Imus Wilkinson. They'll keep you from doing dumb stuff. They also can help you do smart things. And Imus Wilkinson doesn't make anything by churning your investments like too many others in the business do. They make money when you make money. Give them a call today at 777-1911. That's an easy number for most of this audience, 777-1911, and get an appointment to have Imus Wilkinson see if they can help you like they help my family and many others.
Welcome back to Inside Track. Our guest next is John Tierney from the Manhattan Institute, a leading free market think tank focusing on economic growth, education, energy and environment, healthcare, legal reform, public sector, race, and urban policy. Some of the scholars and contributors, besides Mr. Tierney, we've talked with include DJ Jaffe, who has been on the show, the same with Heather McDonald, and Victor Davis Hanson. We expect to have Rafael Manguel, who will be on in a couple of weeks, and Judith Miller and Jason Riley are also with Manhattan. John Tierney is a contributing editor to the Manhattan Institute's quarterly publication, City Journal. Tierney has significant experience in print and media, recently joining City Journal after more than two decades as a reporter and columnist with the New York Times. His fields of interest include infrastructure and transportation, science and society. Welcome to Inside Track, John. Nice to have you on the show.
Thanks, Bruce. Nice to be here.
In your April 7th article in City Journal, the article was entitled The FDA Graveyard. You wrote, "The critics of the Food and Drug Administration were long ignored as they tallied up the casualties in the invisible graveyard of Americans who died because of the FDA's antiquated policies. But now, one small part of the graveyard has suddenly become visible, and it's the need for reform that is becoming glaringly obvious." Now, hardly anybody paid much attention to the FDA, John, until about March 1st. Obviously, big changes since then, right?
Exactly. I mean, it's suddenly become obvious. Most of the damage that the FDA does, it is this invisible graveyard because it's, you know, they just delay so long in approving new drugs and in approving new treatments that people die waiting for these treatments, but nobody hears about them. But suddenly with the COVID virus, we've seen, you know, suddenly that, you know, people can't get masks and equipment. People are dying because of the delays in the FDA and in delaying, you know, testing of people and in delaying getting equipment to people. It's really been, you know, these deaths, finally this part of this invisible graveyard is now visible.
So obviously the FDA is different than the CDC. Sometimes people, you know, kind of mix and match as they look at it. Ronald Reagan, let me just put it this way. Ronald Reagan famously said the nine most dangerous words in the English language are, "I'm from the government and I'm here to help." Lots of people angry about the pace of testing due to the fossilized FDA. So what should be done to change the agency?
Well, I mean, there needs to be a fundamental change in its mission, you know, that it was tasked with the idea of making sure the drugs are safe and effective. Now, there's some case to be made that you want them to test drugs for safety or at least approve them. I mean, in general, as a libertarian, what I'd like to see them do is the FDA can give a seal of approval, and if people, you know, want that, you know, want to feel secure, then they can look for that seal of approval. But otherwise, I think in general, we should let, we have so much innovation going on so quickly in our society, but by the pharmaceutical industry and elsewhere, I think that we should let people, you know, give people the choice. Do you want to wait until something has been approved by the FDA, or do you want to try it because you trust the company, because your doctor trusts it, whatever. Even if one says that the FDA should determine the safety of something, what's really has slowed things down especially is that once they've determined something is safe, they still go through this arduous process that just takes years and years to demonstrate that it's effective, and that it's effective according to these incredibly expensive trials that they do to make sure that it works for everyone. And these things really slow everything down. They, you know, the average new drug now takes, you know, takes more than a decade to get approved. It costs at least $3 billion to develop a new drug. So a lot of drugs that are actually promising get abandoned during that process simply because the cost has mounted up so much that the company figures we'll never recoup the money. And an untold number of drugs never even get tried because people think, you know, there's no way that we'll ever make money on this, especially if it's a drug that that doesn't really have, you know, huge profitability built into it. So I'd like to see the FDA, that, you know, basically whether a drug is effective or not, doctors ought to be able to, you know, decide on their own whether they want to do it. I mean, you know, even if you say the FDA has to determine it's safe, then I think you should do it. And we're seeing that, you know, with this hydroxychloroquine debate that's been going on, because that has not, at first, that was not approved for use against COVID. But doctors were able to use it against COVID because it had been approved already for other things, and they're allowed to do what's called off-label prescribing. And so there's this great contradiction in that, you know, once a drug has been approved, found safe, for, you know, then doctors can use it for another thing. But if a new drug is found safe, until it's been approved for one thing, doctors can't use it for anything. So there's this kind of contradiction that if we think doctors ought to be, you know, should be able to experiment with a drug like hydroxychloroquine, then why can't they do it with something new? So, I mean, that's a larger issue. But in general, there's just incredibly long licensing and approval process for everything. I mean, just on a trivial thing about, you know, surgical masks are not the most complicated project, you know, product in the world, and yet it was just, you know, people that wanted to start making them, you know, there were all these factory owners who said, what can I do to help? Let me use my factory to make protective equipment and masks, and they were told, well, it'll take 45 to 90 days to get approval.
We didn't have 45 to 90 days.
No, I mean, people are, you know, are dying in the hospital right now. And then people who were trying to import them, and then there were all these things that there were massive construction workers had that are virtually identical to the ones that they sell to hospitals, but they're approved by a different agency. And so hospitals couldn't use them. And it took an act of Congress, you know, not until March 24th.
Right, literally.
For Congress to actually pass a law and say it's okay to give hospital workers these construction worker masks. And then there were these other masks from China that are very similar to the one that's used in American hospitals, but they weren't approved for, you know, to be imported because they weren't exactly the same ones that the FDA had approved. And finally, there was so much public pressure, the FDA relented and said, okay, you can import the Chinese mask. So, what this gives you is this very clear, you know, rare glimpse at how the FDA normally works. It slows everything down, and it costs people's lives because it takes so long to get anything done that you go through, you have to jump through so many hoops to do this. And it's really very antiquated. It's based on the idea that only, you know, a bunch of people sitting in Washington have enough knowledge to decide what is safe and to decide what is effective, and what is effective for whom, and what is the right risk for everyone to take. And, you know, but today we have so much more information. You know, this policy dates back to the early 1960s. Today, you know, everyone's got access, you know, instantly to all this information about products, you know, from other consumers, from manufacturers, from reviewers. I mean, people are used to processing all that information and relying on experts around the world to judge these things. They don't need to wait for you know, a group of bureaucrats in Washington to make that decision, and it delays everything. And the other thing about the FDA is that their incentive is just so wrong. I mean, basically, they know that the only thing that will get them in trouble, that will make their life difficult, is if they approve one thing that is, you know, that causes problems later. Otherwise, if they don't do anything, if they just delay approving drugs, they won't get in trouble.
It's like everything else in the government. A decision not made is the one that can't get you fired by. We have Paul on the line with a question. Paul usually asks good questions, so Paul, go ahead for John Tierney from the Manhattan Institute.
I do some business on the East Coast, and I can tell you that there are thousands and thousands of lawyers just waiting for one of these drugs to come in and causing some medical problems. And then here comes all the lawsuits. Now, here's my question. Even though the government approves of these drugs, and it takes years to do it, who is legally responsible in case someone is killed or injured by these drugs? Is it the drug manufacturer, or do people sue the government?
No, that's a great point. You can't sue the government. So, you know, so if a private manufacturer had caused this delay in testing that, you know, that has proved so deadly in the United States, they would be sued. You know, the lawyers would just be lined up to sue them. But you can't sue the government. It's very, 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 it's virtually impossible, to sue them. So they don't pay a price for it. And the point you make is right, that even after the FDA approves something and says it's there, if something goes wrong, that manufacturer can still be sued for it. And so that's what, and I think that, now in general, I think there's way too much litigation in our society, and there's some good reforms we could do for that. But, you know, the advantage of that system is, I mean, these companies have a huge incentive not to put out an unsafe or an ineffective drug because they'll get sued for it. And I think that in itself is enough incentive to police them. You don't need a bunch of bureaucrats in Washington, you know, spending 10 years to decide if they should do it when they themselves have a direct financial incentive to get it right. So, that's a great point you make, Paul, that they're going to, they will suffer the consequences for failure, whereas the FDA doesn't suffer either way.
Well, and thanks, Paul, for your call. So we have in Arizona a constitutional amendment on right to try. Congress has also passed legislation on right to try drugs. Is there a way to get around this 1962 edict for the FDA, where their job, as you wrote, is to determine what is safe and effective? But now it seems it's, as you say, now really what we have is a archaic system that just doesn't work at all, because, as you said, you know, doing nothing is something that's going to keep your job. Otherwise, you might lose your job.
Right. And you won't lose your job, but you'll be hauled before Congress, and it'll be uncomfortable, and so your life will get a lot harder. The right to try laws are a great thing. It took years and years to get there was a national law passed, and states have done it, and these are great steps forward, I think. I mean, I think what we need is, and there are some proposals, I'll be writing about this in City Journal, that there are proposals for much more fundamental reforms at the FDA to basically just, not only to make it, I mean, right now people complain that there's too much paperwork already, that even with this new right to try law, that by the time you go through the paperwork and you do it, and I think the FDA can still say no, when you ask, so it's still too difficult to use, and I think that it doesn't cover enough, it doesn't give enough freedom, that we need a bigger, more fundamental reform of the agency that really just says, that removes a lot of the stuff that it's doing. I mean, the other thing is that the FDA, it also operates by this bureaucratic imperative that you always want to expand your bureaucracy and regulate more and more things. I mean, instead of really streamlining processes for approving tests for a pandemic, which, that it should have been planning for events like this so it could move quickly, it was expanding, it was worrying about regulating vaping. It's been upset obsessed with regulating right. tobacco products. And that's not something, I mean, you know, vaping and tobacco things are not real public health. Those are individual choices people make. We don't need the government telling us what to do on that, but the FDA saw this as a way to expand, you know, more jobs for itself, bigger budget, instead of doing the kind of genuine public health stuff. And the CDC is the same way. They have wasted so much of their budget on stuff that isn't really public health government stuff. It's really kind of more, you know, pursuing their own agendas for what they like to study and how they can expand their bureaucracy. And so neither agency was ready for the main thing that we want. You know, the Centers for Disease Control was founded to fight infectious diseases, and yet it's now become kind of a minor part of their, you know, of their whole budget. So, you know, so we really need to focus these agencies on the genuine missions instead of all this, this extraneous stuff.
Well, John, this is Ev here. Didn't they shut down research on the Ebola vaccines that were coming out?
You know, I'm not sure about that. It sounds perfectly plausible. They did. I mean, they did stop. You know, during the COVID thing, you know, the shocking thing was that there was a, you know, there were researchers in Seattle who had a test that they could use against COVID, and they also had all these blood samples that they've been collecting as part of a study of the seasonal flu. And the researchers said, oh, this is great. We actually have some samples we've gathered. We can, you know, test for COVID in this and see how far it's spread. It'll give us the first good picture of how it's spreading. And instead they were told, no, your laboratory isn't licensed to do that, and you didn't fill out the right paperwork.
They didn't ask permission.
Yeah, they didn't get the right consent form from the people, and therefore they were ordered to stop doing it. I mean, it's just unconscionable. Again, if a private company made a decision like that during a pandemic that we're going to not, you know, deliberately not provide the public with vital information, they'd be sued for it.
And yet over in Europe, all this research is going on right now, and the FDA's not taking that into account in any of its trials at all.
Right. I mean, it's very provincial, and I mean that was a problem with the test that the CDC bungled the test that they made. But, you know, but the reason everybody was waiting for the CDC was that they were the only ones who had the FDA approval to do it. So, you know, there was a test available in other countries. The World Health Organization was developed in Germany, and other countries were using it, but it wasn't approved here by the FDA, so we can't do it because, you know, only the FDA test, and they had put all their eggs in one basket, the CDC test, that turned out to be bad. So, and it just took them months to let some labs do it, and then finally let private labs do it. And, you know, meanwhile, the pandemic's raging, and we have no idea where it is because we have no test for it.
So to that point, you write in your April 7th piece, it wasn't until mid-March, that the FDA, under White House pressure, finally gave private labs emergency dispensation to provide tests without the agency's prior approval. But then it put up a new roadblock when several companies launched tests, which they had said they were going to be sold at cost with no profit for consumers to use at home. The FDA then promptly declared that its emergency dispensation didn't apply to at-home tests, forcing companies not only to stop selling the tests, but to destroy the samples that they had collected. I mean, this is just like classic bureaucracy cluster Fs. I mean, it's just one after another. It's just amazing, isn't it?
I mean, only a bureaucrat could think that way. I mean, yes, I mean, there is a risk that, you know, that these companies selling tests, but these were established companies, too. I mean, these weren't fly-by-night operators. And, you know, these companies knew that if they really put out a terrible test, they'd be sued for it. So they had a big incentive to get it right. But even, okay, maybe somebody puts out a test that isn't great, or that has too many false positives or too many false negatives. Even if that happens, as it gets out there, you know, the knowledge of how well it works is going to be disseminated. People, at least we'd have information from it, and you could look at that test and you'd say, well, they got X percent here, and we know the test had a problem with this, but we can correct for that. It would be additional knowledge to know. And, you know, in some of the tests, I mean, it wouldn't have hurt to get that information out there. And instead they just stopped it. And we're still, I mean, you know, we're still in the situation with the lockdown where nobody knows,
right,
on what to do about it, because we don't know how widespread this is. So, I mean, we're, you know, so it's just, it's been an incredible economic cost, and that's going to kill people in other ways, this, the, you know, the lockdown. So
let me change the topic just real quickly, because we only have about a minute to go. I'll lighten things up. You talked about handshakes in the age of the pandemic outbreak, and I think that much be, I've always thought much can be learned about a person from a handshake, but you suggest the no fear greeting is maybe the simplest, safest, and surest way to say hello for now until after the pandemic ends. Your thoughts on the no fear greeting?
Yeah, it's a real simple thing. You just bend your arm up at your, you know, with your elbow at your side, and you just show your palm. It kind of looks like the Vulcan greeting in Star Trek, or also like the old Western movies where the Indians saying how.
Yeah.
You know, but just showing your palm. It's, the thing about it is that it's a nice, simple gesture. I mean, I think a handshake is great when you're sealing a deal or celebrating a friendship, but you don't need to do that for a casual meeting at a cocktail party. And I think this thing is not only more hygienic, it's simpler. And the other great thing, as I wrote about in City Journal, was that this open palm symbol, it's just an intuitive thing that the brain instinctively recognized that as a friendly greeting. So it kind of, the body language is good, and you don't have to worry about who you shake with, or how long you do it, or how firmly you grip, and you're not going to spread any pathogens.
Hey, John, I like the way you think. I want to have you back on the show soon. You write great, and everybody should go to the Manhattan Institute and read City Journal articles, and I very much endorse it. Great organization, and John's one of many scholars there that are just doing a fabulous job. Until next week, when our friend Eb joins us again, this is Bruce Ash and Eb Wilkinson. Wishing you a very pleasant good night. I'm proud to welcome my good friends at Tucson Iron and Metal Retail to Inside Track as an advertiser. Jamie Kipper and her staff are conservation experts. They sell round and square steel tubing, metal plate and roofing materials, as well as new and used steel, aluminum, and stainless steel to ranchers, artists, interior designers, roofers, and do-it-yourselfers, just like all of the listeners here. Tucson Iron and Metal Retail is open Monday through Fridays, 8 a.m. to 4:30 p.m., and Saturdays, 8 a.m. to noon. Tucson Iron and Steel Retail, 701 East 36th Street. Call 520-209-1576 or go to TucsonIronRetail.com. And when you do call, mention this ad and receive an additional 10% discount on their already great prices.
Imus Wilkinson Investments, 777-1911, is a unique investment management firm. They pay little attention to where the market indicators are because smart investment management goes way beyond checking stock exchanges. They are very good at managing all types of investment based on client expectations. They build relationships, and they want clients, not customers. My family is proudly included among them, and they'll help you, as they did us, design a portfolio that achieves what you want when you need it. Imus Wilkinson Investments, they're really good at what they do. 777-1911.
My part-time service in the Army National Guard makes it possible for me to be more for the community I call home. I'm a better neighbor because my service has taught me how important it is to be a team player. My training helps me in my classes when I give attention to detail to the task at hand. My service in the Army National Guard allows me to keep my country safe from threats. Learn more about how you too can live and serve part-time by visiting NationalGuard.com.
Sponsored by the Arizona Army National Guard, aired by the Arizona Broadcasters Association and this station.
KBOI Cortero, AM 1030, the voice of Tucson. Trusted local news and talk. A Bustos Media Station.